Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to get started. I think I know everyone in the room. If not, I'm Margot Stedman. I'm the Education and Community Engagement Director. We're here for another Soundbites, and today we are here with Mark, of course, our trusty, steady host. We love him. And Alistair Willis, our music director finalist that's here with us this week. We've been having a wonderful week, and as always, we're excited for you to get to know more about Alistair and this process. So thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you for being here. Yes, I'm Mark, the principal trumpet, helping conductors rediscover childhood prayer since 1980. And with me is our conductor for the weekend, Alistair Willis. Hello there, sir.
Hello, Mark.
I'm usually not this close to you. I'm usually
this is very strange, but I'm praying right now.
As well you should. Okay. As you all know, I usually like to start very simply with, what's your story? One can tell from the patois that you're not from the Midwest, initially perhaps, although you do live here now. So where do you come from?
Well, I'm sure I don't know what you mean.
Louisiana born, I can tell.
Well, thank you for that. A great opening question. Before I jump into that, thank you all for having me. I am number 5. And as of Wednesday, congratulations on being halfway through your search. 4.5 down, 4.5 to go. So I've been having a great week here. And my story, yes, the accent belies my Hoosier status. I currently live in Indiana, just down the road in South Bend. And I was born in Acton, Massachusetts. Again, you can't tell that I parked my car in Harvard Yard quite. But my mum was English and my dad was Australian, lived the formative years of my life in England, hence the accent. But goodness me, where am I from? I'm not sure. But I'm not really a Hoosier, but I technically am. So any other Hoosiers here?
All right.
So where did you... What started music for you?
What started music for me? My dad was a journalist, so age 5 we moved from Boston to Russia, and my music started in Russia. My dad was a correspondent, so we lived in a European compound, as you did back in the Brezhnev, Cold War, Iron Curtain days, and the piano teacher would come to our room. A Russian piano teacher, we're sure she was KGB as well, taking notes and looking around, and she taught my 2 sisters. We went in age, so I was the youngest. I went 3rd. And I got to listen to my sisters play the piano and learn from their mistakes or be inspired from them. And yes, Olga was her name. And it was very strict, as you can imagine. If you look down during sight reading, out came the ruler and whack! I still have some scars here you might be able to see. But it was a great grounding in piano. And then when we moved to England, age 10... my sister discovered the French horn,
and she still does.
She plays in a small band called the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. So she's always been my biggest inspiration.
And I would highly recommend you get on YouTube and what is it? Sarah's Horn Workshop, is that the title of the
Horn
Hangout? Sarah's Horn Hangout. It is one of the best musical, just have fun and interview shows you will ever see.
So watching her play the French horn, I'd pick her French horn up and I'd try to play it, and she helped me with her little embouchure, which is the position your lips make when you put the mouthpiece to them. So I liked the trumpet, and I gave that a shot. I had the perfect embouchure when I picked it up, thanks to my sister, and that was my instrument. So let's continue this prayer and just have a moment for my middle sister and my parents, who had to suffer me practicing downstairs, Sarah practicing upstairs for goodness knows how many years. It was
and
loud.
What about the other sister?
Well, her excuse was that somebody has to be in the audience.
I see. Okay. It works for me. So where do you go to college and all that? And what got you into conducting? Let's put it that way.
Yes. So playing the trumpet, a bit of the piano, but singing in choirs. I sang with a lot of different conductors. Some were inspiring, some were not. And as I got into my late teens... I sang and played with a couple of conductors that made me go, wow, there's more to life than just black and white notes on the page. Music became more real to me. I got a few what I call aha moments. and really found music moving me, changing my life. And I've since really wanted to share that, give that back to audiences or orchestras or choirs or whoever I'm in front of conducting, because music is life-changing. Can we imagine life without music? I mean, we all know that. You're here. You're all music lovers, I'm sure. But can you imagine watching a movie without, well, black and white, were, of course, movies a long time ago were silent movies, but they had music to them. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine, as I told the kids today, some of the kids at Hillman Elementary this morning, can you imagine having a video game without music? Can you imagine turning on the TV, there being no music? Music is life, and it's changed my life, and I'm just, I guess, in service to perhaps change other people's.
It's interesting you mention movies without it and then silent movies, but silent movies had music. Actually, in the silent movie days, they took the music quite seriously as to accompanying a movie, and a lot of it, of course, was improvised by the organist there. But especially in the early days of movies, the music was a huge part. I mean, just look at the scores everyone here remembers from the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, you know, Korngold, Nichols Rosa, Steiner, you know, you name it. So when did after college, after training, where did you, how did you move up?
Right. Where
did
you go to? So I digressed. I'm sorry. So I went to Bristol University and I did some conducting on the side there, realized let's give it a more serious shot. I ended up in Houston, Texas at Rice University doing what I thought was my master's, but it apparently was my master's. and then straight out of Rice University, after being a fellow at the two biggest music festivals, Aspen and Tanglewood, I got a job with the Cincinnati Symphony as assistant conductor for 1 year, and then 3 years with the Seattle Symphony as their assistant conductor. So ended up living in Seattle for 19 years, met my wife there, and the last 3 years been living in South Bend.
When you were at Rice, was Larry Livingston teaching there at the time?
No, Larry Ratcliffe was my teacher, but Larry Livingston was not there, no.
Okay, because he was at Northern before I got to NIU, and he went to Rice after Northern, so I thought you might have crossed paths. What type of music, how do I phrase this? This is because a question I've always wanted to ask. When you're not grooving out to Palestrina and various motets, what do you listen to?
I only groove out to Palestrina.
Ah, okay. So. Well, in that case. What do you listen to for recreation?
You know, that is, I get asked that a lot, and the answer is not a lot. When I'm in the car driving, I prefer talk radio or podcasts. When I'm running, I try to stay fit, and I don't listen to anything. I've got so much going on in my mind, and this is a blessing and a curse, because at nighttime, I can't find the switch on me which will turn that off. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's very hard to fall asleep. My wife will say, you know, you're conducting again, Alistair. You know, and she can tell, you know, so what movement are you in now? You know, and it's really hard. But to really rock out, perhaps, and change everything up, that comes from having a seven-year-old daughter. And right now the rock out is the new Lin Miranda musical movie called Encanto.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
She, I tell you, don't talk about Bruno, whatever, Casa, whatever. It's just, I know all the words and all the songs. It has been playing nonstop, and she loves that. So, but it's actually great music, mm-hmm. and I enjoy it very much. Yeah. But if I had to say, I'd say Queen, the rock band Queen.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I could rock out to them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
How about you? What do you listen to?
A little of everything. I'm a big jazz fan. I have a pretty big collection of jazz. There's a band that is unfortunately disbanded out of Czechoslovakia called Egg Noise that is absolutely phenomenal. As a matter of fact, I am in touch with the leader of that, and a guy named Ondrej Galuška is his name. Lives in Prague. He's a teacher there. I listen to a little bit of everything. Sorry, not a big country music fan. So I don't mean to offend, but not my thing. But pretty much a little of everything. With an orchestra, kind of veering off into a little bit more philosophical realms, where do you feel the place of the orchestra is in a city such as Rockford or in an area such as this? Where is its place?
place of an orchestra should be the hub of culture and the leader of inspiration. There is nothing like coming to hear a live orchestra play. We can grab young kids, maybe with a Peter and the Wolf or some educational program. I mean, I remember the first time I heard Peter and the Wolf live, and that got me fascinated with instruments, and we had musicians coming to our school giving assembly with all the percussion instruments or all the brass instruments, and this was really formative for me. To have a place where you learn from school and you learn from your parents that you can go to with other people, your classmates or other, to go and not really worship music, but I guess that's what it is. It's a concert hall is a cathedral for music, if you will. And it's so important. It's better than listening to a recording at home, because we all have access through YouTube, through social media, of any recording ever made, probably, and we always will. But to be in that hall, to experience the thrilling risk of the moment, where anything could happen. A string might break on the violin soloist. How are they going to deal with that? They're going to grab the violin from the concertmaster, and then the violin gets passed back. The mend the string comes back. I mean, it's so much going on at any one time. And if you are familiar with a piece of music, you can connect with that perhaps stronger. If you're hearing a piece of music for the first time, I mean, can you put your minds back when there wasn't really radio or YouTube or any kind? The only way you could hear a music was going to hear live. Beethoven symphonies, you know, they had premieres. They weren't always well received. Wouldn't it be amazing to go back in time and hear brand new music? I mean, Mozart and Beethoven, these were rock stars of our time. It's a little different definition now. But to hear music live, to hear world premieres, to hear something for the first time, this is what people lived for and loved. And today we're like, oh, there's a world premiere. Well, I'm not sure. I don't recognize the name of the composer. But there's Beethoven on the second half. I might give it a shot. You know, we've become like that. The society has become like that. So my job is to help realize these magic times, the magic of music, of being in the moment, being there, experiencing it. And music brings us together. Music is about relationships. You all know each other here. Margot knows everybody in the room. I'm hope to get say hi to each one of you here, because we connect over the arts and music. And of course, music can be an enabler for a community to bring even more people together. So it's a loaded question, and I've only touched the tip of the iceberg, because it's a very, very deep answer and big, complicated answer.
And how music and the production, reproduction of music, even in the last 20 years, thanks to the YouTube and streaming, and as you say, so much is available now. You don't even have to have, you know, I still collect these, and thank you again for bringing this to me. But you don't need these anymore. You can get all kinds of stuff just on streaming. Although I must say, you'd be amazed at how many historic recordings are not available in digital formats. That's why I save these. You know how many people said, I wish I hadn't given you all my records when I bought CDs? I said, I know. Kind of getting off on that subject a little bit more. How would you see... the orchestra, how do you bring people into the orchestra? Since, as we said, so much is available online, music is ubiquitous. How do you go about presenting a piece or a concert as, you know, come to this, come see it live?
Well, there are many ways to do that. And as I'm sure your former music director would have proved, it takes time to build relationships, and your trust in him grew. And when he programmed something that you perhaps weren't familiar with, he had built your trust over time to say, let's give that a shot. Let's listen to that. Let's come and let's support. So programming, of course, can really help. How many of you have heard a tabla concerto before? Great. Well, if you're coming, as I imagine you are, on Saturday night, you're going to hear something that potentially could blow your mind. it blew my mind when I heard it. When you write tabla on your computer, you got to be careful because it changes it to table. And we're not doing the table concerto. You've got to make sure it says tabla. Tabla are two Indian drums, one slightly smaller than the other, played cross-legged. We have one of the best, if not the best, tabla players in the world with us here. And what he does with his fingers and his wrists and his arms, it's just mind-boggling. And it connects on a level of awe, a level of musicianship, of humanity. He is an incredible performer and so energetic. And the skill is incredible. So this can really attract interested percussionists all around, probably will be flocking to the concert. I will want to know about this because it will broaden our understanding of world music. The first half, as you know, is Silk Road. So that creates, in my mind, what is the Silk Road? What is Silk Road music? And I want to know a little bit about that. So this could perhaps, with the right marketing and trust over time, build, wow, I want to go hear something from the Silk Road. What I do in South Bend is every year we have a different Silk Road performer. Sandeep has played with us, and we're up to four now. And everyone's always, I can't wait for the next Silk Road performer that you're going to bring. So again, that's a way to spread the news, to spread the love, to get the interest, how you can widen the blanket, the carpet for is to really to outreach the schools, you know, get kids there. They're a future of our audience. I always say that the most important audience of a symphony orchestra is the board, because without the board and the money, we are nothing. But the second most important audience, and only just slightly second, are kids.
Let's go off on that tangent. Sure. What do you do, or would you do for outreach? What do you think is the best ways of reaching kids and getting music back into the schools?
Right. Everywhere, schools are suffering for not so much music education. We know that. It's not here, not just in South Bend. It's everywhere. What is the orchestra's role in music education for a city? That has to be defined by many people, not just one. To make a school visit like we did today with Sandeep playing for the Hillman Elementary School, those kids were enthralled. I saw myself years ago when we were visited at my school by these players. They will never forget that. And it will be a positive experience for them. Now, these kids are not supposed to be... the visit was not intended for them to become tabla players or musicians, but to have a positive experience which might, in later life, lead to a moment where they can make a positive decision themselves. It was so positive. It was so happy. Music can be so important. So I think with kids, outreach is so important, to be connecting with the school teachers, the school district, having them come to the Coronado, experience a concert in the amazing hall that you have here, but also for small ensembles or a conductor or a staff member or yourself. I'm sure you've been to schools and played times. Mm-hmm. And then there's a personal connection, and it all grows over time, takes time. And then, of course, kids start learning learning instruments themselves and getting a tactile sense of what playing music and what producing music is about. There's so many things just feed and ripple off each other. And finding the best ways depends on the community. It depends on the direction we all agree to take together.
What kind of things have South Bend done under your leadership to get out to the schools? What kind of things have you promoted?
We have what's called Symphony to Go, STG. We have a woodwind quintet, a brass quintet, and a string quintet. And they go out and they play about 70 performances at retirement centers, at libraries, but at schools, mainly at schools. And they will perform for an assembly-like situation. And we do that a lot, and we have been seeing more young people come to our concerts, or young people bringing their parents with them to our concerts, and this outreach is very important. We also, of course, have our what we call YPDC, Young People's Discovery Concerts. We've been doing the Carnegie Hall Link-Up program the last few years. We do two back-to-backs on 2 days, so that's a 10:30, then a 12:15, and the buses all around the hall. It's a wonderful sight. Bus them in, bus them out, get the next lot in, and we have about 6,000 to 7,000 kids for that 1 week.
Now, this is a question that perhaps doesn't have an answer, but have you, in your work with South Bend and the IRSA before, how do you get to the teachers and the administration of the schools to emphasize that importance? It just seems that they just don't get it like they did when I was coming up through school. I mean, my first elementary school experience was in Buffalo, New York. And this is before I started playing, which wasn't until I got to Illinois. But I remember assemblies to watch Bernstein's youth presentations in the school. Don't see that anymore. How do you have any thoughts about that?
I do. We have a Margot.
We do too.
You have Margot. Our Margot is called Christina, but
call you Christina.
No, Margot.
Okay.
She's connected to the teachers. She is the liaison. Christina's been an educator for 20-something years in South Bend. She knows everybody. She knows the ins and outs of all the schools, and that connection is great. So, for example, when we're doing the Carnegie Hall link-up, what that means is that there's a set program, and all the resources are provided by Carnegie Hall. They're called link-up because I don't know about you, but when I was younger, going to the symphony at an education concert, you'd sit there, and you would just be entertained or you'd be educated. But Link Up has a way of involving the musicians. Mm-hmm. So the musicians come prepared either with a song to sing along with a symphony or recorders or...
Oh, Lord, recorders.
Indeed.
We've done several of these, too. And
indeed,
as you well know, if you have not heard the sound of 2,200 5-, 6-, and 7-year-olds with recorders... horror movies have been built around that sound, but it's wonderful.
I'm right with you there. Yes, the prospect is like when I was first asked to do one of these, playing the Blue Danube Waltz. Are you kidding me? No way. But they've been well trained.
Yes.
And they'd been connected through our Margot to get the materials in advance, been encouraged to learn them. Some of the schools didn't, and they sat there, and they still had a great time, but they weren't quite. But I think the point is that when you leave a link-up concert, you can tell your friends the next day or that night, hey, guess what I did? I performed with the Rockford Symphony Orchestra. I performed. I sang with them. I played with them. Mm-hmm. And so it's interactive. Now, of course, you could make your own homegrown version of that, which we have done as well. Don't have to call it Carnegie Hall Link-Up. But that to get the kids prepared for that takes a lot of work and liaison. And to answer a difficult question, we've managed some success through our Margot.
There you go. Working with choirs, you've done quite a bit of that, I would assume, with the orchestra. What kind of things have you done with them? I mean, besides the obvious Beethoven 9, you know, that type of stuff.
Oh, we haven't done Beethoven 9 yet because we had a pandemic. And the voice, of course, all of a sudden was the most lethal instrument in the world and nobody was allowed to sing. it must have been hard for brass as well. I mean, strings can at least wear a mask and still breathe, but it's very difficult. We did Verdi Requiem. And we're going to do Beethoven 9 next season, fingers crossed. I've done smaller choral works with South Bend, including the Haydn Paukenmesse Mass. But over my career, I've done pretty much all the big stuff. Beethoven 9 a few times, Carmina Burana a few times, Belshazzar's Feast by William Walton, one of my all-time favorites.
We did that many years ago.
Oh, it's such a great piece. And to keep working backwards, my first conducting job was with a choir. I'd sung in some extraordinarily good choirs, and when I was at university, my three best friends had been boy choristers at big English cathedrals, and we formed a little barbershop quartet. I can't tell you, their sight reading, their diction, their enunciation with their pitch was just amazing, but our style completely was awful.
Oh, that would be an interesting barbershop quartet with English choristers. That
the King Singers-esque. King,
yes, exactly. How do you work with choirs? Do you look? Do you approach conducting? Do you approach your technique differently when working with a choir than working with instrumentalists?
I approach my technique differently for whoever I'm in front of, whether it's a choir, an orchestra, a different orchestra, depending on the orchestra, or a bagpipe ensemble, which I've never conducted, but I'm ready to adjust if I need to.
I have a set at home.
Oh, you do? Hopefully from the next village away, I'll be ready to. So what's really important is, and I was given this advice, is that you can't conduct the same way for each orchestra. Well, yes, we have a basic pattern and a basic technique that is universal, that people know that's a 4-bar, a 3-bar, or a 2-bar, and you can communicate that way. But choirs are kind of like you are, right in front of me. An orchestra goes over here, right? So it's a little different. If you're a choir, you're seeing, I can conduct up here, and I've got all of you there. But I've got, if I'm doing this here, then I'm neglecting you. And if I turn to you, you've got to have got a wider embrace, if you will. So you've got to think about all these things. It's always a challenge, but starting with choirs, back when I did that years ago, the thought was that choral conductors need to be choral conductors, and they cannot ever become an orchestral conductor. And I said, hang on, I'm gonna see if I can prove that wrong. So at Bristol University, I conducted the choir 1 year, and I could have auditioned to conduct it the next year, but I went for the orchestra, and I won that. And I'm still one of two conductors in Bristol University's 200-year history who's ever done choir and orchestra while they were a student there, which is remarkable. But then you think of ballet, and you have an orchestra, but you've got to accompany dance. That's quite challenging because dancers with short legs go a little quicker. With longer legs, you've got to slow down just a little bit and adjust the tempo. And when you do that, you've made best friends forever. But then you add opera, where you've got singing, soloists, choir, choruses, often dancers, and an orchestra. And that's where every little technique that I've learned from chorus, from ballet, from orchestra comes into focus. They say opera is the hardest to conduct, and they are correct.
I had to chuckle when you talked about the dancers, shorter dancers, taller dancers. A number of years ago, in one of our Nutcracker performances, we're doing our first run-through without dancers and everything, and we got to one of the ones with a male principal dancer, the Nutcracker, and Steve says, okay, let me give you a warning. This is going to be a little slower because the guy dancing this is 6'2". And it was a little slower just because you just, trust me, I'm 6'3". You don't move that fast. I know. My problem with these interviews is they're only an hour, and you say something and I'm thinking of five different things I'd like to ask. Most of it minutiae that probably would not interest anybody, so I have to be careful. But you're talking about choir conducting and that. For years, until fairly recently in the conducting world, you were an opera conductor or you were a symphony conductor. And there's great opera conductors that most of us have never heard of because, you know, but you never see them in front of an orchestra, and at least, you know, until recently, vice versa. You've conducted opera, I'm sure. Why would that have been? What do you think was that difference that isn't quite so cut and dried these days?
When you go to a concert, couple hours long, with an intermission. When you think of the opera repertoire, some of them are many hours long and so intricate with individuals, choruses, duets, trios, dancers. There's so much more to a 3-hour opera than there is, in general, to a two-hour concert. To be a good opera conductor, you've got to start dedicating your life to that early. If I was a better pianist, I would have been really interested in going the German repetiteur route, which is you join an opera company as a pianist, and you accompany all the rehearsals for the main maestro or maestros, maestri, and after 4 or 5 years, you've played the repertoire and you've learned from the greatest conductors coming through your opera company, and you're ready to pick up the baton and do something because you've had that hands-on, tactile knowledge of the score in an intimate way and a huge repertoire. And it takes years to do that. Repertoires usually move up then to the assistant Kapellmeister, then the GMD, the General Music Director, and it's a long journey, sometimes taking 15, 20 years to get to that. But once you've got there, your knowledge, your command of the repertoire, your ability to help and shape and create and inspire is incredible. I realized at an early stage I was not going to be able to do that with my pianistic abilities. I have conducted about 12 operas in my time. Every time I do it, I love it. I wish I could do it more. But there are people who have dedicated their lives to it more than I have who deserve it more. I'm a concert conductor who can do opera and ballet and chorus, but I'm primarily a concert conductor. It's when you've got that ability to do opera, then it's all time consuming. That's why you don't do concerts, unless you want to make time for that yourself.
That was a question for me. I apologize. I've always wondered. As a conductor of an orchestra, how do you see yourself working in the community and being an ambassador for music, to use a hackneyed cliched term? How do you see that, the role of a conductor that isn't, you know, Chicago, New York, where, yeah, you got to do something, but you don't have to do a lot when it comes to that. However, here, you know, in an orchestra like Rockford, South Bend, Elgin, you name it, regional orchestras, you have to be a lot more involved with a lot more people. How do you go about doing that?
You have to love people. You have to be good at personal relationships. And you have to be available when the board asks you to and the staff needs you and the musicians need you. On the other flip side, every time I leave the house in South Bend, I could be recognized. I often am, not always, because I can wear dark glasses and a hoodie but everybody knows my dog. So if I'm seen with a dog, they'll wave, you know, no matter how incognito. Oh, there's the maestro's dog. Oh, hi, Alistair. But in supermarkets, walking downtown, when I go to the theater and hear the Civic Theater or go to hear a choral performance or something at Notre Dame, people recognize me immediately. So I've got to make sure I'm dressed okay as opposed to unless I'm running with my dog. But it's a 24/7 job to be an ambassador for an orchestra, because everything you do is public, and it's important to be in the public to be promoting and talking about music. As Arnie was saying in my interview on Monday, you get recognized at the produce section at the supermarket. Now, I've got to say, I just went to Schnucks for the first time, and nobody recognized me, and that was great. I had a wonder. I mean, that's very rarely. And I even lingered in the produce section, thinking, "Is anyone going?" No, we're just going to keep going. But it's when I get stopped like that, I'm always trying to turn the conversation from how good the last concert was. Will we see you at the next one?
Let's talk a little bit about the music that we're going to be playing. Let's start with the first piece, the string piece, whose name I am spacing because I don't play on it.
Ascending Bird. We could write you a part. Ascending Bird by Colin Jacobson and Siamak Agai.
Tell us about it.
Well, now here is, and I will, I'm not going to shun away from this, but some of you might be coming to the pre-concert talk. And so the challenge now is, having had 3 or 4 interviews on podcasts, on radio, is to not say the same thing like, oh, I've heard him say the same story. So I actually don't want to say too much about it, because I'm going to say something from the podium in the concert for our maximum audience who are there and deserve to hear.
Okay.
but I can give you a bit of background on it. So the first half is Silk Road along with the second piece. And when I was asked to come up with some ideas for my audition week here, I kind of thought a bit selfishly. What is it that is unique about me that would show me in a different light than perhaps any other candidate? That's an okay selfish thought to have, right? And I look back in my career and I think, well, one of the things that sets me apart is my work with Yo-Yo Ma's award-winning Silk Road Ensemble. Have any of you got to see that, see him live? It's just incredible, isn't it? I got to conduct them on tour several times and work with them individually as well, and it's been some of the most rewarding musical experiences of my life, of my musical career. So, as I mentioned, in South Bend, we've had now four individuals come and play concerto, just like Sandeep Das will be doing with the tabla concerto, which is your next question. Back to your first question, the piece...
He knows me too well.
The piece Ascending Bird is a Silk Road piece. Colin Jacobson and Siamak Agai are members of the Silk Road Ensemble. They wrote it together. Siamak is Iranian and plays a santur. Colin Jacobson looks Middle Eastern, but he's 100% American and plays the violin amazingly. And this piece is just highly evocative, highly picturesque. And I don't want to say any more of it than that at this stage. Just that I hope that will get the juices flowing in the interest. It's an incredible, incredible piece. We played it a lot on tour.
Now, the I'm sure you have heard tabla. It happens in movies. It happens in television. It's a sound that I think will be somewhat familiar to you. But in this context, it is different. And as different world musics have different aesthetics, they have different ways of listening. We mentioned bagpipes. Okay. I actually was learning the bagpipes. I haven't picked them up in quite a while. And so I was just getting to the point where you could actually recognize the tune I was playing. But I happen to love the music. And if you get into the history of it, it has its own, again, its own aesthetic, its own ways of listening. It has, since the bagpipe is either on or off, and I'm talking about the great Highland bagpipe, not the Irish Illan pipe, which you also hear a lot of in music, in movies, because it's more flexible. The Highland bagpipe has 9 notes and no dynamics and no articulation. So, all those little fancy burbles you hear, every one of those is notated. Every one of those you practice. There's tarlawas, lemlawas, dithros, ethros, gthros. What's the burl? That's the one you hear goes blup on the very lowest notes. That's a burl. That's a very specific finger movement.
There will be a test later, so I hope you're taking notes.
Do take notes. Anyway, what I'm trying to get to in my, and I can never be brief about anything, I apologize, is a lot of that stuff that is incomprehensible. Once you start listening to it and learn what it means, now you start listening for where the expression is, because the expression is all in the timing and in the particular ornamentation in pipe music. Tabla, I'm sure, has its own very dense and rich traditions to it. And, you know, you were saying how amazing he is. You don't believe fingers can move that fast when you hear him play. And how it integrates with the Western-style orchestra is pretty amazing. How did you come to this piece?
I came to this piece because Sandeep said, hey, my friend Dinuk Wijenartney has written a tabla concerto. You want to play it sometime? And I'm thinking, hang on, tabla, how can two small drums keep my interest for 25 minutes, a couple minutes for sure, but 25 minutes with an orchestra? Tabla is used to sort of playing on its own or in the background. You can have a solo tabla recital. These are very popular, very common in India and other parts of the world, but otherwise we will have heard tabla in Bollywood or in film scores, or you will have heard the sound but might not know what it is. Now it's to the fore. It's our main focus. It's our concerto instrument. And so how on earth could this hold interest? But then I thought, hang on, this is the greatest tabla player of our time. I mean, he'll figure it out. And the composer is amazing. So I was open. I said, let's look at the score. And I fell in love with it. And this will be the third time that I've done it with him.
Okay, it is an amazingly interesting piece and very intricate, but it does take some open-mindedness to understand the various nuances that you don't hear the first time you hear something like that. And that's true of any style of music, mm-hmm. You know. What I mean, Beethoven was, the late Beethoven was incomprehensible to the people. Now, the late string quartets are, you know, they're gorgeous, but it's nothing like, oh, this doesn't sound very good. Mm-hmm. Now,
can
yes,
I give a
please.
Just, I'm not going to tell too much about the tabla concerto because I've invited Sandeep to come to the pre-concert talk. So if you want to hear him demonstrate and show some things, come to that. He is amazing. But to give you something to think about, it's a classical concerto in that it has three movements. The first one takes us through a history, if you will, of music. We hear a Bach melody, and he accompanies the Bach melody, and it's like, well, that's interesting. The second movement shows the qualities of accompaniment that the drums have. So he doesn't come to the fore. In fact, the first solo goes to the trumpet in a Miles Davis kind of very cool way. But the third movement is what we're waiting for. Who's been to a solo tabla recital? Neither have I. What happens at the end of a tabla recital is that, as an encore, often the tabla player will play something that they've written themselves. And how you learn the tabla is through, not through music written down, but through memory. And you put a sound to every note, like ta. Ta de dinda. And so you hear back, and he will, and the tabla player will do this at the recital. So, you know, you're thinking, of course, well, that's pretty cool. But Dinuk Wijeratne puts that concept into the third movement. The first thing he does in the third is say something and then play it. And you're going, oh, my gosh, I got that. So that's how we would have learned it, through words, which you can write down, and then fingers, and then after ta, we can all do that. Ta de din da, you can use your make the sound of the drum. You know, da ba bum bum. You can do that on the tabla, and you're thinking, oh, anyone can do this. And then he goes, and I can't even begin. But it's just, and you're like, how does he move his tongue that fast? Let alone his fingers. And you're going, okay, that's impressive.
And we're trumpet players, and we can't figure out how he does that.
He triple, quadruple, septuple tongues better than anything I've heard ever.
Oh, yeah.
It's incredible.
He is. And, of course, there's not much you can say about Prokofiev that hasn't already been said, except, you know, Romeo and Juliet. What more needs to be said? And we'll get a little bit of narrative to it also.
Yeah.
Any questions for Alistair while we're here at the moment? Something that I haven't asked him that you want to know. Sir? So is Ascending Bird similar to the Lark Ascending in any way?
No. I adore the Lark Ascending. Well, you know, Classic FM in England, they did a survey of all classical music. You could vote for your top pieces, your favorite, the listeners of Classic FM. We're talking a million people at least. And Lark Ascending was number one back in about 8 years ago. It's that beloved national anthem sort of piece of music for British people. I love it. It's very calm. It's about a tiny little bird soaring above. It's about 13 minutes long. It's just a gorgeous piece of music. If you don't know it, listen to it. It can send you to sleep. It's very soft and very, very slow, but it is gorgeous. Ascending Bird is energetic, bigger bird, much bigger bird, a mythical bird that's on a mission. That's all I want to say. And it's full of unbelievable energy and is about 7 minutes long.
More Firebird than Lark Ascending.
Definitely more fire, but still not Stravinsky at all. But more that way, yes.
Ah, suggestions for tabla on the internet.
You can go to Sandeep's website. You can go to YouTube and put in tabla, and you can come up with all sorts of things to listen to. You could listen to, I think, the first two movements of this concerto, which are on there with him playing. And there are commercial recordings. If you put Indian tabla music, you'll get a whole different set of qualities of the tabla, how perhaps it was originally intended with Indian instruments like the sitar and other percussion instruments. So you can hear it in its original context. Even just getting a picture, I have one on my phone, but I couldn't probably see it, but and seeing what they're like, and will also help with familiarizing yourself with the visual of what it's like, and seeing somebody, maybe you're going to be sitting a long way away at the concert, and his fingers will look like a blur. So maybe on YouTube you could get up and have a close-up of a camera on the fingers, and you can be seeing it. Try doing it in slow motion, and you still can't keep up. It's just incredible.
This is true. What have you done in South Bend? What have you been programming in South Bend over the last 3 years?
Well, that's an easy because the first two of those 3 years we had a pandemic.
That's true. I keep forgetting about that. He doesn't have that much.
I'll jump straight to the last year.
Okay. Well, why not?
Well, something happened during the pandemic that we jumped on in South Bend, and that was after George Floyd. We decided to accept our responsibility in the classical music world of our part in racism in music. We formed a DEI or an EDI, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, however you put those initials, committee. I was on it. I was one of three token white people on it. I love saying that. And this committee has been making such an impact for the symphony and our community. We have come up with a mission statement and a vision statement, and we are committed to programming a certain percentage of underrepresented composers, whether it's African-American, Latino, female, and we are already well into year one doing that. We've always had a Martin Luther King concert, but that has never always been all African-American music because it's really a mixture. We have a gospel choir singing at the end, so they're probably not going to be singing Beethoven. They're going to be singing something in their genre, which is always thrilling to hear. But we had our very first, we made history 2 months ago with our very first classics, we call them masterworks, of African-American composers. Quinn Mason, who's a genius, 26 years old, probably the hottest thing in classical music right now. We did a piece of his. He came to the concert. We did a piece by Florence Price that was premiered the same year as William Dawson. And we called it American Composers because that's what they are. Since forming the committee and that concert, our DEI committee has been working in the community. We've been sending our ensembles to give be part of our MLK celebrations in black churches. We have been reaching out. The head of our DEI committee is a well-respected African-American, retired former dean at IUSB, Indiana University, South Bend, and he gets things done. So this really has affected our programming, influenced our programming. Other programming includes we did Schumann's Second Symphony along with the Barber Violin Concerto and a piece that I premiered 8 years ago based on Jabberwocky. You know the famous poem from Alice Through the Looking Glass? It's just probably one of the best pieces I've ever premiered. Then we did, of course, our Home for the Holidays concert, our best-selling concert. We've done a all-string program to begin with because we didn't want to risk, having woodwinds and brass there so early because the danger, all singers. So we did a piano concerto for strings and including Tchaikovsky's Serenade for Strings. We worked with Adam Neiman from Roosevelt, an amazing pianist. He wrote a concerto for piano and strings. We did the American composers. The last concert we did was focused on the environment. There's a piece called Terra Nostra, Our Earth, written by a Seattle-based composer who I happen to know, friends with, went to the premiere by chance in 2015, blew me away, and couldn't wait to program it. There's like a National Geographic film that goes along, which the orchestra accompanies. It takes you through the history of the world, if you will, and where we are. Some of the moments are quite dark because of its environment, and the industrial age is hit, and there's a lot of Stravinsky and certainly no lark flying or Firebird flying at that moment. But it ends with hope. It's such a beautiful piece. We had a Silk Road performer come, Kenan Asmer. And in our last Masterworks concert, which is next week, we're doing something which I started a few years ago. We call it Alistair Presents. I have a bit of a theatrical background, and I write concerts, not the music, but I write a script, make it dramatic, use visuals, often write for another actor, and I will perform as well as conduct. This particular one is probably the one that's closest to my heart. It's set in my favorite time history and in my favorite city, Paris, the turn of the century. The other character is Serge Diaghilev, and we talk about his connection with the Ballet Russe, his connection with Stravinsky, with Debussy, with Ravel, and Poulenc, and lots of others, because with all of this explosion of the arts, he was the enabler. Pablo Picasso, Leon Basque, all these greatest artists, poets, musicians, dancers, they all came to him. Diaghilev couldn't dance, paint, act, or sing. But he was the greatest of them all because he brought them all together, of those who could, in this glorious fusion of color, art, and sound that the world had never known and Paris hadn't known. So I create a concert about this. The first half is before World War I, ending with a bit from The Rite of Spring. And the second half is after World War I, where Paris, of course, they knew how to celebrate, and it's a bit of a lighter second half. So it's a program that's very dear to my heart, but that's quite a variety of programming for our first year back after a pandemic.
Very true. Now, we're running out of time quickly, and so no. Talk all you want. You talk more, I have to do less. One more question for me. As a player, there's pieces I have always wanted to do and never have had the chance to yet. As a conductor, I'm sure the same is true. So what are your top five that you haven't been able to do yet and want to?
Along with that comes, who's your favorite composer? If you're going to ask that, sorry, I'm going to answer that. If I had to answer that, of course, variety. Ludwig van Variety. I need variety. But the one composer who makes me think and just changes me in the week of conducting is Gustav Mahler. I've conducted four of his nine symphonies, or nine and a half. He wrote a tenth but didn't finish it. Somebody else did, so you could say there are ten, but they're at least nine and a half. And I would love to do those other ones that I haven't at some stage. I'm in no rush at some stage.
I'm older than you. I am in a rush. Mahler 3, please.
Mahler 3, please. I would have to say that on my bucket list would be to conduct Wagner's Ring Cycle. 16 hours of music. When I moved to Seattle after Cincinnati, the Seattle Opera had a tradition of every 4 years doing a full Ring Cycle in the summer. They would do three. It takes about 9 days to get through it, or 8 days, and then you a few days off, and then you repeat.
Don't worry,
that.
There are bathroom breaks.
Well, 9 days to get through, you know, because you have to give the singers and the orchestra rest in between. But I sat through three cycles of that while I was there at every rehearsal, and learned, and just that has got to be some of the ultimate for all conductors, to conduct the Ring Cycle. The conductors who came through, I'd ask them how they did it, and well, they would spend the 4 years programming one act of Götterdämmerung, you know, 2 hours in a concert, or doing the Parsifal, doing the Siegfried's funeral music, or doing just bits from the operas, so that they could sort of get their hands into it. But that's where being a repetiteur at the in the German opera system coming through, you'd learn that over 20 years or so. So I would love that. That is just so important. I'd love to do Wagner's Ring Cycle.
Yeah, there's we all have some obscure, some not. I definitely would like to do Mahler 3. I would love to do, and I never will, Hans Rott's First Symphony.
Oh, that's gorgeous. That's
fantastic. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's like a contemporary of Mahler.
Mm-hmm. Slightly before him. And if you listen to Hans Rott's, I think it's the third movement, and then you listen to Mahler's, you know where Mahler got it from, because Hans Rott wrote it first.
Strauss Alpine Symphony?
Oh, of course.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And Ein Heldenleben, for that matter. And the full brass choir version of Michael Tilson Thomas's Street Scenes.
I don't know those.
Yes, that's very deep in the bucket list. It's unbelievable. We are almost out of time, I'm afraid. We have a couple of minutes. What would you like to say to us?
You realize you have a fantastic orchestra. You all know that, don't you? Yes. I've been saying everywhere on podcasts, TV, radio, what a gem you have here. And that's not just thanks to Mark and his colleagues, not just thanks to Steve Larson. That's thanks to you. You know, if a tree falls in the forest and no one can hear it, does it make a sound? Well, without an audience, does an orchestra make a sound? You wouldn't know. Oh, of course we do. We know the answer to that one. We do make a very loud sound. But we music has to be shared. And if we didn't have an audience, we would have nothing to share. So your connection, your dedication and love of the arts, and how that ripples out into your community, that's fantastic. An orchestra doesn't exist on its own. Thank you for keeping this art form and this orchestra alive with your support and love for it.
Well, the way I always put it, especially to my students, is we say we play instruments. Well, you've got to play with somebody. And an orchestra plays with the audience. And, you know, if there's no audience, but thank you. Thank you for an enlightening conversation,
thank
as
you,
always. You couldn't tell he has a theater background, could you? Mm-hmm. And thank you for coming. And as I always say to you, come to the concert tomorrow and bring a friend or three, okay? Thank you.